the first thing that I learned about her was that she was the head of the jazz band of the school. This, we're talking about the late 1910s. I mean, jazz was just born. I think the first major influence wasn't so much the Western education, but the fact that she came from a Sikh family. And then there is another goal. After meeting Amrit Kaur's daughter, is, you know, to fulfill her desire to know what happened to her mother. This was a different story. This was much more original. This woman was, you know, front line in fighting for women's rights, right to women's education, against child marriage, and against polygamy. This is a real spoiler. This was the biggest surprise. I really didn't know about that.
Before we join Livia and find out what she discovered during her 12 years of research, let's start by providing a brief overview of Amrit Kaur.
Amrit Kaur was born in 1904 as the fifth child and only daughter of Maharaja Jagajit Singh and his fourth wife Rani Kanadi. The Amrit Kaur in question is often mistaken for the more famous and more well-known Dame Amrit Kaur. Dame Amrit Kaur was Maharaja Jagajit Singh's first cousin, both of their fathers, Gadak Singh and Hernam Singh, being brothers and the sons of Randhir Singh Ahluwalia. The Dame was a key figure in India's independence movement and was the country's first female cabinet minister as the Minister of Health. The Amrit Kaur in question attended and was a member of a jazz band at Clovelly Capelstone Boarding School for Girls in Sussex. She then continued her studies in Jersey before completing them in Paris. On February the 5th, 1923, she married the Raja of Mandi, with whom she had one son and two daughters. In the following year, she visited London, and on the 26th of June, she had her photos taken at the Lafayette Studio located at 179 New Bond Street. It's somewhat unclear what happened to her after this point up until her death sometime in the 1940s. Authors such as Eliza de Gay claim that the Rani perished in a concentration camp during World War II. This was after being caught by the Gestapo for attempting to rescue a number of French Jewish intellectuals. Others state she was captured by French collaborators with the Nazi regime, transported to an internment camp, and used the sale of her jewels to release not just her own freedom, but that of some of her other detainees. To help sift through fiction and pin down fact, I invited Livia Munira Sambi, the author of In Search of Amrit Kaur, an Indian princess in wartime Paris, to learn more about this amazing woman and her fascinating story, which includes Kapurthala, or Kapurthala, a princely state of Punjab descended from Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, Franco-file royalty, London, Paris, New York, Bombay, Brussels, Bern, the Second World War, Winston Churchill, Cartier, espionage, worldwide travels, forbidden relationships, world-renowned photographers, a daughter who never knew what happened to her mother, a suitcase appearing in America, an Antarctic explorer, Nazi internment camps, the British Library, and a tale that is never quite as simple as you assume. Now, before we begin, I have to obviously say a massive thank you, and secondly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you to you, Omar, for the attention. I'm very pleased you liked the book, read it and liked it.
I'm not saying this just because you're on the podcast, but honestly, it's one of the very few books that I've had a hard time putting down. And I think that's simply because of the way it was written. It was absolutely fascinating, but also very gripping, the way that you blended in your own kind of personal story with all of the stories of the people that you had researched and met, and then also how that all kind of connected to create this beautiful tapestry of Amrit Kaur's life. However, before we get started, I would love to just get a brief introduction as to who you are.
So I've had a very long career as cultural journalist. I write for the leading Italian newspaper, daily newspaper, Corriere della Sera, and I've been writing about books and writers, mostly profiles of books written, of writers who write in English language, so American, UK, Indian, Nigerian, etc., for many, many, many years. And then I started writing books myself. This is my second one. The first one was also a very personal collection of profiles of North American writers, among which there was Philip Roth. And I did two documentary films with Philip Roth right after. So from the moment I start the research for the book about Amrit Kaur, to the moment when the book comes out, I've written another book and done these two films and worked with the newspaper. The arc is quite large. It's 12 years since, you know, the beginning up to now. Anyway, this is who I am professionally.
That is amazing. 12 years. Now, what inspired you then to write the book? Obviously, I've read the book, and so I kind of have a rough understanding. But what made you think, hold on, let me spend 12 years and kind of going from research to book?
Well, maybe one of the things I was thinking about it, you know, 5 minutes ago before I called, is, you know, there's nothing like encountering difficulties, obstacles, you know, to push you to try and solve the mystery. But, you know, the truth is, at the very beginning, it was this amazing picture, this wonderful portrait dated 1924 of Amrit Kaur of Mandi, as she was called then. She was born in Kapurthala, who was 20 at the time the portrait was taken. This photograph wasn't known because it was found not long before among all the other photographs of the archive of a certain photographer who was very popular, I mean, popular among aristocracy in the 1920s and 30s in London. It was found in the attic, abandoned, of a house that was going to be renovated. And so the collection ended up divided between the V&A and the National Portrait Gallery in London. So no one knew really that these pictures. And I was really struck by the label that accompanied the picture and the portrait of this beautiful, beautiful woman who was so elegant, so graceful, and with an air of melancholy about her that really set her apart, because all the others were, you know, male maharajas covered in jewelry, you know, completely different. She was much more elegant and much more beautiful. And the label said that she was the daughter of the Maharaja of Kapurthala. She was the wife of the Raja of Mandi. She'd been educated in the West, England and France. She came from a family that was really Francophile, and they spoke French at home. And they had a wonderful collection of jewelry, very famous collection of jewelry. And she was said to have sold her jewels to help Jewish friends leave France in 1940. And a letter received by a stepmother of hers, you know, she had many stepmothers because the father married many times, stated that she died in a Nazi concentration camp a year later, 1941, after being arrested with this accusation. So it was this mystery. Can it be true? And what's the story? Why a Sikh princess? You know, it was such a cultural short circuit, you know, Sikh princes in occupied Paris who would do something like this for Jews, and it's arrested by the Nazis. It was so strange. And there was also something else. I saw it as, you know, a story of loss. And 2 days before going to Mumbai for a job, which is the reason why I was there, to interview and to profile the Indian writer Bikram Chandra, I'd gone to the funeral of my only brother. So this, you know, and I had been in Mumbai, wandering in Mumbai, like in a fog of grief. So the idea that this beautiful young woman was arrested and killed, you know, that she did such a sacrifice, maybe, really touched me in a way that was very special.
So once you had been kind of inspired or first learned of Amrit Kaur's story, then how did you go about kind of researching the story and trying to actually kind of get down to the facts of the case? Because I can imagine, and especially reading through the book, there's a lot of hearsay and there's a lot of kind of gossip and there's a lot of statements that are made without much kind of clarification. So obviously this, the center of the story being that she was arrested in Nazi-occupied Paris and then used her jewelry to save other people. But how did you go about ascertaining what was true and what was kind of fiction?
Well, the first thing I did, I asked an Indian independent filmmaker, Tanuja Chandra, who's the sister of the writer Vikram Chandra, that I befriended in Mumbai. I said, can you help me? You know, I'd like to know whether a story is true. Can you help me find someone in India who can do this research for me? And this was very quickly done because I immediately, you know, very shortly after, I received an email from this researcher that she had found, who said, I'm sorry, the story is not true. I spoke with the daughter of the Rani of Mandi, of Amrit Kaur, and she said that the story is not true. This is her name. She is Nirvana Devi, Devi of Bilka. This is her cell phone number, and this is her address in Pune. And so I thought, well, too bad. It's not true. And I put it away. It was also, you know, a year and a half later, I myself moved to Paris from Italy, from Milan. And by opening the carton boxes that I brought with me, you know, this sheet of paper came out. And I thought, oh, I forgot about this. And I'm really a bad journalist because I didn't check. I don't even know who this researcher is. Here, you know, I should have called this lady and asked her about her mother. But it was a very difficult phone call to make because, you know, how do you call an elderly lady on her cell phone and ask, is it true your mother died in a Nazi camp? It took me a while to find the courage to do that. But when I did, I found a very, well, I thought she's going to hang up on me and she's right, you know, so unpolite to pose such a question. But instead, I found a very welcoming voice on the other side and of the line. And she said, well, it's not true that it's not true. It's a bit different. My mother was arrested in 1940. And she was sent in a Nazi camp, but it wasn't a concentration camp. It was an internment camp in France run by the Germans. And she did die in 1941. She died in 1948 in London. And I think there was an exchange of prisoners. So she was liberated after 6 months in the camp. So, but why don't you come and see me? And I thought, oh my God, I just moved to Paris. I can't just leave like this. And I thought it was just polite. But then I understood that it wasn't just politeness. She was, you know, there was something inviting in her voice, you know, kind of longing. And so a year and a half after I did, and the first of the big obstacles, you know, came out. I sat in front of her, turned on the tape recorder. I said, well, can you tell me about your mother? And she said, nothing. I said, come on, nothing. I came all this way. And she said, no, nothing. She left us in 1933 when I was 4 years old. She never came back to India. And she was never spoken about in the family again. So what can you tell me about my mother? And I was stunned, you know. At that point, I had done some research. So I had things that I knew that she didn't know. Her old daughter didn't know. So I started telling her.
It's fascinating when you're reading the book, the instances that you recount of meeting Amrit Kaur's mother and the exchanges that take place. And I think what I found most kind of gripping was just the way that you're able to convey emotion quite clearly through words. Because it was almost like, as you're reading through it, you're almost picturing it in your head, like you sat opposite this lady and discussing the history of her mother. Just then focusing slightly on Amrit Kaur and her childhood, her education, kind of everything before she ends up in Paris and gets sent to this internment camp. What could you tell us about that?
Well, the very first thing that I found out through, you know, Wikipedia was that she was sent to study. She got a European education, and she studied first at boarding school for girls, of course, in Sussex, called Cloverly Cloclet, it was called. I mean, but this was, shortened. I have to look at the name again. And this was a very special school because it was very open-minded. It was, you know, incredibly diverse. 30% of the girls were Jewish, which accounted for maybe Amrit Kaur having made good friends with Jewish girls. And they were girls from all over the world and all sort of religions. And it was very advanced. And the first thing that I learned about her was that she was the head of the band, the jazz band of the school. So this, we're talking about the late 1910s. I mean, jazz was just born in New Orleans. You know, this music of black people in New Orleans, they were already playing it. And among the people who went to give conference to the schools, were actors, great theater directors, even Ernst Shackleton, the wonderful explorer of the Antarctica, who lived nearby and so went often to give lectures there. So she was exposed to a very advanced, very progressive, very cosmopolitan culture. Then she moved to, I learned later, to some school in Jersey and to France. And this was, in a way, you know, a blessing, but also the opposite, a curse for her. Because for a girl to be, at that time, to be sent in the West and get, you know, this incredible education, then come back to India for an arranged marriage with someone who may have not got the same kind of education, that created a cultural conflict. And everybody agreed, you know, people interviewed, that she was very, very unhappy in her marriage.
What influence do you think Amrit Kaur's kind of relationship with her parents and the fact that she's sent to these boarding schools and she's spending massive amounts of time, essentially, like, I know she's in a school with other pupils, but she's on her own for all intents and purposes. How do you think that helps mold her as she grows older? Because it kind of seems like there's almost like a turning point in terms of, she's kind of, at one point she just kind of disappears almost and goes and does her own thing and kind of goes off and doesn't really tell anybody. I can't remember what part of the book it was. I think they're on a ship and she decides to essentially kind of go off with her friend. And then the evidence that you speak about is, I think it's a book or it's a plate of something, and it's got Amrit Kaur's name on it with the lady that she's with at the time that her mother wasn't even aware of. Her daughter wasn't aware of even. So how do you think her upbringing and her education and kind of, again, as you mentioned, this cultural conflict that she's dealing with, how do you think she's molded by it, but also how do you think she deals with it?
Well, I think the first major influence wasn't so much the Western education, but the fact that she came from a Sikh family, and that in the Sikh religion there is an equality between women and men. So she was definitely, you know, much more ahead, if you confront her culturally with the women that belonged to other religions, you know, that followed other faiths. And she was, everybody agreed that she was stubborn. She had a very strong personality. You know, she knew what she wanted, and she used to get it. And then all of a sudden, she's not, you know, trapped in a place where she can't have much influence and where she can't be free. So these were difficult things for her to absorb, I'm sure. And in fact, she rebelled. There are things rather not talk about, because you find them out in the book, not, you know, spoilers, no spoilers. But anyway, yeah, then, and in fact, you know, it's not surprising that the day she disappears because she has a free life.
Slowly moving towards the crux of Amrit Kaur's life. Why is she in Paris just before the outbreak of the war, considering, like, I would have assumed, considering she's like part of the aristocracy and her father is very much embedded in the political system, that they would have had some type of warning or would have known, perhaps? So why, like, what is she doing in Paris and why hasn't she left by this point?
Because, you know, this happened to so many people, and particularly to very privileged people who, as you said, would have had warnings. They didn't believe it was happening to them. They didn't believe the war was really coming. They didn't believe it would touch them. They thought, you know, it was this kind of, in a way, a sort of a sense of entitlement, you know, politics won't touch me. I'm above this. And too many people made that mistake. And among them, I know, you know, some families here in Europe personally, Jews who didn't leave, who, you know, in Italy, didn't leave even through Mussolini's time. And then they were slaughtered at the end of the war. You know, why they had all the time to go away. So, yeah, I think that is the answer.
How is she caught in Paris? Like, is she trying to leave and then that's kind of like they see her paperwork and they don't let her out? Or what happens?
She tries to leave. She desperately tries to leave, but there is no way you can, you know, the Germans, they arrived very swiftly. They conquer the north of France, you know, and very few weeks. She was first in Brussels when the Germans moved west, and the German army. And then she arrives with the people fleeing Brussels and stops in Paris, and then she's trapped. And then she is arrested the 8th of December 1940. She's arrested actually because she's an alien enemy. Because one of the things I found out is that that week of December 1940, 3,600 women and children with British passports, many of them Indian, you know, who were living in France, are arrested by the French police as a favor to the Nazis. So they're acting for the Nazis. They give them all to the Nazis, and they're taken by train in an abominable trip that lasts 3 days instead of 3 hours. The distance would have been 3 hours. But the trains went all over around France because there was a confrontation with Winston Churchill, who found out that they were taking these women to a place to send them all to Nazi camps in Germany, labor camps. And so Churchill threatened, and through the Red Cross, he threatened the Germans, saying, if you do this to these women and children, I'm going to send all our prisoners, German prisoners of war, to the Canadian tundra. So you weren't, you know. So this negotiation lasted 3 days. And then they were finally sent to Besançon, so still in France, but to an awful place, a barrack, Napoleonic barrack, with no heating, no food, terrible hygienic conditions. And, you know, 600 of them apparently died just the first month because of cold and diseases and, you know, lack of food.
So how does the information then of Amricourt being arrested finally get out? And who is first alerted to try and help her?
A spy, actually. You know, it was really telling and interesting to me. I'd never done a research like that before. If you look for evidence in France about the effects regarding World War II, you'll often find a wall of silence, documents that are being, you know, burned, made disappear, like this regarding the arrest of all these women. I found nothing because the French collaborated a lot with the Germans, and they don't like this to be, you know, we know all it, but, you know, they'd rather not let it know. So I found a thick dossier about Amricourt of Mandy at the British Library in London. And there I found a telegram of the agent that was a double agent working for them, you know, who told them about her arrest, and, you know, all the correspondence, especially by her husband and by her father, who tried to liberate her.
And then why were they ultimately unable to get her out from the internment camp then? Or were they not successful?
They were not successful. They were not successful, apparently, because the Germans had no interest. Actually, they had interest in liberating her in exchange for a very important spy, a certain Filchner. But the British said, she's not important enough. You know, we're not releasing to Filchner, who is in the camp, prisoners of war camp in India. We're not releasing him for her. She's not worth it. So some other way must have been found. And I think a friend helped her. But this is a spoiler, so we shouldn't say who. Yet.
Yes, definitely. Everyone listening should go and get the book and read it, because it's a gripping book, but also just the history that's interlaced within it is fascinating. So no, definitely. Just then, with the kind of the center of obviously Amit's story to be saving Jews within this internment camp, to what extent is that true? Is there some truth in it? Or like, obviously I don't want to give too much away because people need to go and read the book, but how could you possibly enlighten us in regards to that?
Well, not too much, because otherwise I would give away. I mean, that it's a mystery book in the end, you know. The book is really the story of a quest, and the goal of the quest, there are two goals. One is solving the mystery of the jewels, and then there is another goal, after meeting Amrit Kaur's daughter, is, you know, to fulfill her desire to know what happened to her mother, and you know, to, in a way, find closure after almost 80 years of being in the dark about why her mother abandoned her. And luckily I was able, you know, to find out proof that the mother wanted to come back to India but couldn't. And then the war made everything much more difficult, if not impossible. So the truth about the, you know, many obstacles about this story of the jeweler, jewels, because when you have jewelry so important, you know, made by Cartier, for instance, with the gems that come from India, you sell them back to Cartier. This is what everybody told me. But the big jewelers would, you know, their deontology is against revealing the names of their clients who find themselves in difficulties and have to sell them back. So I found nothing there, but I did find proof. Two things. One, that she did sell at least one very important piece of jewelry, saying that she was doing it to help a Jewish friend. And the other thing that I found out was that, you know, the story was much more complicated. You know, with many nuances that I didn't know about when I, you know, started.
What then do you think was perhaps the most interesting or surprising thing that you found during your research? Obviously, there's a whole lot in the book that people can read and find out. Yeah. But for you, what was perhaps one of the takeaways that you're like, I really wasn't expecting that?
Well, you know, just finding out that no one knew. I mean, not even her daughter knew that she had a big involvement. She was very committed. She had, you know, she had been an activist for women's rights in the 1920s in India. That was a big surprise. You know, there are so many books. We're all fascinated, I think, with the stories of, you know, the Maharajas and the Maharanis of the Indi, you know, of the time of the Raj, and of course also before. But this was a different story. This was much more original. This woman was, you know, front line in fighting for women's rights, for right to women's education, against child marriage, and against polygamy. And I didn't know, she gave an interview to an American newspaper in 1927, so when she was 23 years old, about these themes. And, you know, it was very impressive. So that was a fantastic found.
What then happened? Sorry, actually, quick question before I move on to that one is the bit, and perhaps obviously if we divulge too much, I will edit this out so that we don't spoil anything for people listening. The bit that really gripped me, and I've actually kind of made a note to try and research it further, was the evidence about her relationship with the other lady that was also arrested and kept in this internment camp. What could you tell us about that, and what could you share in terms of what you discovered during your research?
Nothing. This is a real spoiler. This was the biggest surprise. I really didn't know about that. So no, you should edit this out.
No, I will.
I'm happy to answer the question when you don't record.
Hold on, let me pause. A few moments later. Okay, so then what ultimately happens with kind of Amrit Kaur? So eventually she does get out of the internment camp.
Yes.
And then what does she do post that period? Like, what happens to her kind of further on down the line?
She's stuck in France. She's stuck in, you know, she tries desperately to leave. She asked to go to Morocco. She asked to go to the United States. You know, every time, every request meets a no by the German authorities. Her father and her husband tried to help her get these permissions, but they failed. And she lives a miserable life. Because she's stuck in Paris with no money. What the Germans did when they occupied the north of France and then the rest later, they froze the assets of all the Jews and the alien enemies. So these people had literally no money whatsoever to live on for many years. So they had to rely on friends. Luckily, her family had friends in Paris, so they were helped. But you know, she was and she starved. She had debts. She was in a miserable condition, and she was sick. She was sick because this internment camp was absolutely ghastly. And when she managed to leave after 6 months of detention, she was in very bad health, and she never really recovered. And finally, she died at the very end of the war when she was in London. And the reason why she got to London, because in it was impossible to come back to India. It was also a very bad time at, you know, the partition and what was happening in the Punjab, where she was from. So they told her the only way to get some money from India, money she was entitled to have as a Rani, you know, she had a stipend. In order to get this money, she had to be in England. It was the only place where they could send money to her. So she did. She did go there, but then she died.
Wow. So kind of essentially after she comes out of the internment camp, she doesn't actually recover then?
No.
In terms of from her, yeah, her health must have deteriorated.
Yeah.
At what point then does she end up going to America, or is it just the fact that, or do I have it mixed up? Because obviously in the book at some point there is something that is discovered in America that belongs to Amit Kaur. How does that end up there?
You know, that's a spoiler. What can we say about this? Well, doing a research, an historical research, for me at least, it was a wonderful experience. And, you know, it's a mixture of great satisfaction when you find something, even tiny things, and great frustrations too when you find, you know, a lot of closed doors. But, you know, there was at a certain point an amazing surprise. And this amazing surprise was a briefcase found by someone who had nothing to do with her many, many, many years later in a garage. At the time of, you know, when someone was selling this garage and they had to move out, clear all the stuff. And while clearing the garage, they found this briefcase. And in the briefcase, there was the story I was looking for. There were letters and photographs and telegrams and, you know, so many personal documents of Amrit Kaur. How this briefcase ended up in California, I won't say, but yeah, that was a magic moment. And also, you know, I'll always be grateful to this woman who very generously shared the stuff with me.
Yes, no, definitely. I remember reading that bit in the plane, and I reread it about four times because I was like, huh? Because obviously a lot of that period of history, especially with the Ranis and Maharajas from India, has a lot to do with Europe and England. And very rarely do you hear of kind of stories of them in America. Obviously, a lot of them travel, and there are kind of diaries and newspapers that record these visits. But yeah, that was definitely one of the very key and gripping parts of the book. So everyone listening, definitely go and read it and find out. There were two questions that for kind of listeners of the podcast sent in, and I don't know whether that's because they've mixed up this Amrit Kaur of Kapurthala with another one.
Sure.
Because obviously she passes away kind of soon after the end of the Second World War, and their questions were kind of related to obviously post the Second World War, how does her experience influence her political activism? And then on top of that, another question was kind of her role in India's independence movement. But
yeah,
considering her kind of deteriorated health and the fact she died soon after, I wasn't too sure whether it
You are right. You are absolutely right. It's easy to confuse her with a cousin of hers, not a close cousin, but a cousin who was actually much more important historically, Rajkumari Amrit Kaur of Kapurthala. She was an absolutely towering figure and 30 years older, so they're a generation apart. And I would have been I really looked into this to find out if they met, if they had any relationship. Both were in same blood, you know, at a certain time. But I found absolutely no proof. Rajkumari Amrit Kaur of Kapurthala, who was, I think, Gandhi's first female assistant and the most important one, and the first woman minister of health in India after independence. She came from a branch of the family that had converted to Christianity, so to Catholicism. So this is the reason, I think, for their not being close at all, you know. There was a great divide there. There had been also a dispute about the throne. The two branches of the family were not close. So yes, you know, the two questions you were asking really are regard the other.
The other, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I did think so, because I was like, well, if she's passed away soon after and the Second World War ends in kind of 45, then like there's not much time for her to be doing anything really. But no, I just wanted to obviously verify with someone who knows the women a lot better than I do. So thank you for that. How did you then kind of balance the personal and political aspects of Amrit Kaur's story, considering the narrative could very well be written in a number of ways, but how did you manage to kind of balance those things so finely?
Well, first of all, I had a very good editor, a couple of them at least. But the thing is, the book tells the story exactly how it happened. It's not like I had great difficulties with the structure. There is a personal element to the way I tell the story that happens at the beginning, you know, what was happening in my life at the time when I saw this picture and I started doing my research. And this is the first two chapters. And there is a last chapter that is also very personal. But everything here, everything in between really happened the way I told the story. And finding out, so it wasn't difficult for me. That was... it was not an issue. Not everybody agrees that, you know, that was the only way to tell the story. There might have been others, but for me, this is what I lived through. It was also very important. In the end, it's a story, you know, this long quest really gave shape up to my life and had a very positive influence to my life too. So it made me understand a lot of things about myself and relationship between mothers and daughters, and you know, and a lot of things about loss. And it was also great medicine against loss, you know, finally grasping what happened to this woman and why she was it intentional or just it happened that she was deleted from history, to give her back to readers and to her own family was extremely important for me.
What message then do you hope readers take away from the book?
Oh, message. So many messages.
There are.
The first one that comes to my mind is that the glamour usually associated to the Indian royal families, it's not all there is to know about, you know, that's the surface. And then the stories can be more complicated, deeper, more interesting, more conflictual, and helpful to understand our own stories. So that's one message. Another message is, well, beware when you start the research because you don't know what you're going to find. I hope the book is very respectful towards Amrit Kaur's family. I really cared about it. But, you know, there are cultural differences. There are things that you can say in the West that are harder to say in the East. I don't know. You know, it's difficult. And then, you know, another thing is there were women in the 1910 and the 1920s and 30s in India that were very forward, that were, you know, ahead of Gandhi, for instance, who came quite late to understand the importance of women in Indian society. This is something to be proud of. There was a strong proto-feminist movement that contemporary Indian women can be proud of.
No, definitely. So penultimate question then is, obviously we started the conversation and you spoke about the challenges and kind of the number of challenges that you enjoyed facing during the writing of this book. But the question is kind of, what challenges did you face? Like, as you were researching this, I think one of them, just from the listening to you speak earlier, was kind of how in France, obviously, it's quite difficult to find anything that relates to this period of time due to the fact they don't really want to shine light on their own collaboration with the Nazi regime. But besides that, what were kind of some of the challenges that you had to kind of overcome during the writing of this?
Well, also, you know, a certain cult of silence in her own family, of which the daughter was, you know, a victim in the sense that she was not told about her mother for all her life. So she wanted to know more. People were not willing to share with me what they knew. In a way, also understandably, because a number of books that were really quite salacious and you know, scandalous were about the Kapurzala family before. So it is understandable that they didn't like writers pose another writer posing questions. And what else? What kind of obstacles? Well, the obstacles when you're researching the life of someone who, yeah, she had a public role, but she wasn't, you know, she didn't have it for a very long time. She wasn't a historical figure. But at the same time, that was a surprise. You know, it really made me think, look how much, in the end, I managed to find out about her. It would be interesting to take, you know, just a person at random and see, thanks also to the internet, today so many things are available, so much information is available. You know, what you're going to find out, what you're going to dig out.
The last question then, in what way did the research in writing this book impact you?
Well, I'm aware of the fact that the reader at some point of the book will ask himself or herself, why is she doing it? And I'm aware, you know, why she's facing all these difficulties, why she's traveling around the world to meet people, was Amrit Kaur so important? Why, you know, what is the real motivation? And I know that the reader will be asking this question because Amrit Kaur's own daughter, Bubbles, asked me the question. Yeah, she was the first one to be surprised. I went on like a blind person saying, you know, why? Because it's interesting. Of course, it's interesting. She, you know, because the portrait was so beautiful, because the mystery of the jewels and helping the Jews and her arrest. But there was much more to it. And it is amazing how blind I was to my own motivation. And I found out about them. I can't say what they were because, as you said, the book has a structure. It's a story that has a structure. And this is the last surprise of many surprises. And it's a very important one. And it's a very personal one. But yes, it has had a huge impact. And all I can say, it was a wonderfully positive impact. It's something that literally changed my life.
Well, I'm obviously personally glad that you wrote it because it was absolutely fascinating. And equally, people listening to this hopefully will go and now buy the book because it's definitely worth it. I think we've been very careful not to share too many spoilers or any spoilers, hopefully. So I just wanted to obviously say thank you and just double check. I've got to the end of all the questions I wanted to ask. Is there anything in particular you wanted to perhaps mention or include?
No, thank you. I think you did a wonderful job. I'm thanking you. You're a very good reader. and a very good interviewer. So I've been on your, I've done your job many times, and I recognize someone who does it really well, you know, who's also passionate about books and meeting the writers. So it's been really my pleasure.
Oh, no, thank you so much. It means a lot for coming from someone who genuinely, I read the book and I was like, wow, if I could write like this, I would be very happy. So I definitely take that compliment and I will store that for a long time. So thank you. I will leave you to the rest of your day and hopefully talk soon.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. If you managed to make it all the way to the end of another podcast episode, this would be a great time to ask you to like, comment, and subscribe. It means a whole lot more than you can imagine. Also, a quick shout out to all of our YouTube members who are supporting the work that I do, including Jas S, Ensing, Gavin Shergo, Prab Amrit, RB, Gary Parwar, GS, Gurpreet Dunjal, and Nadaji Kaur. And also a shout out to our Patreon members, Neil B, Hernan Pezano, Jazz Dylan, Gurpreet Singh, Gurdi Bhatt, Himat Singh Khalsa, Anish Mar, Ramneet Kaur, Mani Singh, Rav Singh, Ramneet Kaur, Amardeep Basi, Yasmin Jaswal, Gurgan Singh, and Kajinder Singh. If you want to support that work that I'm doing, you can do so via two methods, either become a patron or join and become a paying member of my YouTube channel. So if you are interested, check out the links in the description below. Otherwise than that, hopefully see you in the next video.